their own offering with a consistent style, theme, and colors. Shirts on one side, pants on the other, dresses at the back, all the same three colors. This is one of the best clothing departments I've seen. Beats a lot of stores we have overseas. Back on the plane to see a couple new stores in another town, I asked Peter what was so exciting about the display. Customers get the opinion of a trusted source, he said. Someone you trust has made picks so you don't have to. Nobody has time to wade through foggy seas of endless decisions. They give up or make bad choices. That display says here's the color, here's the style, here's what you want. Take it or leave it. There are less decisions so you feel confident and trust the opinion. Early in my career, I worked a summer job helping a buyer for fish in an American supermarket chain, he continued. We had every kind of fish. We had every kind of seasoning. It was all fresh. It was priced well, but nobody bought it. We couldn't figure it out. Finally, we realized customers were scared of buying fresh fish. Which one tastes best? How do you season it? How do you cook it? Too many decisions. So we changed our section. We only carried three kinds of fish at a time. Not 10, not 15, three. And we had one kind of seasoning for each. So you suddenly only had one choice to make. Cajun trout, teriyaki salmon, or lemon sole. Once you made your pick, the fishmonger dipped your fish in the seasoning and the label printed off the instructions on how to cook it. What happened? Sales were up over 500%. I realized fewer choices means faster decisions. Our brains don't need to mentally step into each new option and stretch out inside them, picturing them, evaluating them, holding them in our heads while we step into the next option. Fewer choices means faster decisions. How do the President of the United States and the CEO of Facebook make every decision at twice the speed? Less time spent on decisions means more time for everything else. What does President Obama tell us about making every decision at twice the speed? You'll see I only wear gray or blue suits, he said in a 2012 Vanity Fair article. I'm trying to pare down decisions. I don't want to make decisions about what I'm eating or wearing because I have too many other decisions to make. You need to focus your decision-making energy. You need to routinize yourself. You can't be going through the day distracted by trivia. You can't be going through the day distracted by trivia. What about Mark Zuckerberg, founder and CEO of Facebook? I own maybe 20 identical gray t-shirts, he said in a Today interview. I mean, I wear the same thing every day, right? Mark's not turning heads on the runway, but he doesn't care. His goal is building the world's largest social media company. A minute more a day picking a t-shirt is a minute less a day he's thinking about his work. The Curious Case of Benjamin Lee. Cutting decisions, chopping decisions, cutting them out. It takes me back to my first office job many years ago. I was 22 years old and had just graduated from university when Procter & Gamble hired me as assistant brand manager for CoverGirl and Max Factor makeup. I started the job in the summer. Benjamin Lee was the first person I met on my very first day. Chinese, in his mid-20s, Ben had thin, jumpy eyes, close-cropped hair, and wore tight, dark clothes. I assumed he was a Zen master because his desk had no pictures, no artwork, and no office work on it, just a tiny bowl of rocks punctured with three bamboo shoots. Ben's desk was right beside mine, and after a few weeks of working together, I started noticing his style. Black shoes, black socks, black pants, brightly colored shirt. He looked good. Simple style, everything fit. Can I ask you a question? I asked him one night while working late. Where do you get your clothes? He laughed. You won't believe it. Once a year I buy 30 white boxers, 30 identical pairs of black socks, 15 custom fitted dress shirts, and 5 pairs of black pants. I do laundry once a month. I never match socks. I never shop on weekends. I never spend any time thinking about what I'm wearing. It's always the next thing in my closet. You'll probably see this blue shirt again in a couple weeks. I thought back to a couple months prior, when I'd spent an entire Sunday shopping for what to wear on my first day at work, and a couple minutes every morning picking clothes, laundry every weekend, and forget ever matching socks from the dryer. Ben continued, I calculated that never thinking about what to wear, doing laundry once a month, and going shopping once a year saves me 15 minutes a day on average. Maybe more, because I don't lose any frictional time jumping between thoughts, so I get 8 to 10 hours back every month. That's an extra week of waking hours each year. Do you know how much I can get done in an extra week? I knew how much Ben could get done in an extra week. He was on the fast track, delivering results, well-liked by peers and bosses. Although he worked long hours like everyone else, he wasn't working more hours than everyone else. He simply made better decisions by making fewer decisions, by reserving his decision-making energy for things that mattered. I had friends who spent time picking out cufflinks, matching ties to socks, turning heads with trendy shirts. I know those friends wouldn't trade in time shopping for the world. Wasted time? No, they loved that time. But for me, I started thinking about other things instead of thinking about what to wear. How much time was I spending making decisions every day? And which ones weren't important? The most exhausting idea I've ever had. I decided to spend an entire day writing down every decision I made and then looking at which decisions I wanted to chop out of my life. Ben outsourced his clothing decisions. What could I outsource? This is the first step to understanding which decisions you can chop. An annoying process, but worth it. Here is every decision I made in one day. It started off like this. Should I get up now or sleep in a few more minutes? Should I get up and go to the bathroom to have a glass of water? Should I go to the gym? What should I put in my breakfast shake? Should I put in yogurt? Should I put in spinach? And it went like that all day, all the way to how I got to work, what I was doing at work, what I was doing at the gym, what I was picking for lunch, what toppings to go on my sandwich, all the way like that until I got home. Should I check my email? Should I stay up later to read? What time should I set my alarm? On and on and on. What a day. In total, I made 285 decisions. Exhausting. What were they about? I'm embarrassed to admit I made 75 decisions at the gym, 62 decisions about checking email, and 32 decisions about food. These three topics alone were half of all my daily decisions, yet they were things that didn't really matter. Sure, it's great to go to the gym, but there's no reason I couldn't studiously follow a written workout. Sure, part of my job is being responsive, but I would still be responsive if I checked email twice a day in 15-minute windows instead of as brain padding whenever I found a spare minute. And I love food. I never want to skip meals. I never want to eat at my desk. But a preset shake every morning with dinner leftovers every lunch would give me food I love and save 32 decisions a day. What does all this decision-making do? Why was I so tired when I got home at night? Turns out the answers were right in front of me. What do you find every morning and lose every night? Imagine you start every morning with a bright yellow sponge firmly implanted in your brain. Sounds painful, but good news, it's a magic sponge. This bright yellow sponge makes all your decisions for you, just like that. Make a decision? A little chunk of sponge cracks off. This happens throughout the day. And what happens when the sponge is completely gone? You're spongeless. You can't make decisions. And there are only two ways to regrow your sponge. Food and sleep. Until you eat or sleep, you are mindless and ripe for making bad decisions. John Tierney is the New York Times best-selling co-author of Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. He says, decision fatigue helps explain why ordinarily sensible people get angry at colleagues and families, splurge on clothes, buy junk food at the supermarket, and can't resist the dealer's offer to rust-proof their new car. No matter how rational and high-minded you try to be, you can't make decision after decision without paying a biological price. It's different from ordinary physical fatigue, he concludes. You're not consciously aware of being tired, but you're low on mental energy. Many people are familiar with the painful process of walking around a giant department store and picking items for a wedding registry. When Leslie and I went to Hudson's Bay at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning, we were full of energy. Yellow bowls or blue bowls? Dark yellow or light yellow? Shiny or not that shiny? What about glasses? Should we get 8 or 12? Heavy or light? Do we need tall and short, or just tall or just short? What design? What about wine glasses? Do we need 12 as well? What shape? What brand of blender? How many blankets? How many pillows? How many towels? What color towels? By the end, we were exhausted. Our sponges had disintegrated. I remember the clerk asking if we wanted to add a $300 ice bucket at the end of our trip, and us nodding with glassy eyes and our mouths hanging open. As John Tierney says, once you're mentally depleted, you become reluctant to make trade-offs, which involve a particularly advanced and taxing form of decision-making. To compromise is a complex human ability, and therefore one of the first to decline when willpower is depleted. If you're shopping, you're liable to look at only one dimension, like price. Just give me the cheapest. Decision fatigue leaves you vulnerable to marketers who know how to time their sales. And this isn't the only reason that sweet snacks are featured prominently at the cash register, just when shoppers are depleted after all their decisions in the aisles. With their willpower reduced, they're more likely to yield to any kind of temptation, but they're especially vulnerable to candy and soda and anything else offering a quick hit of sugar. The only person whose rules you have no choice but to follow. I struggled investing money for years. I read a book on how to do it myself, and I knew I had to try carving off a small percentage of income, move it to an investment account, and put it in a diversified fund. There was no reason not to invest. But at the end of the year, every year, any money I tried setting aside was just sitting there. Not invested, no increases, no dividends, no nothing. Just getting eaten away by inflation. I felt stupid, lazy, and forgetful. What was wrong with me? I looked back and found a horrible case of decision fatigue had set in without me even realizing it. When this happens, people have only two options. One, make no decision. Two, make a bad decision. My bank didn't have an automatic investing feature, so I had to do it myself. I set a calendar reminder on the first of every month to try and move some money into investments, but whenever the first of the month hit, something happened. I looked at the price of the fund, and if it had risen over the previous day, week, or month, I said to myself, "Oh, I don't want to buy it now. It's too expensive. I'll wait a couple of days until it comes down." Then I'd keep checking the price every day, multiple times a day. Occasionally, it would come down, and I'd buy some. But sometimes, it would keep rising. So I'd watch it go up, and keep telling myself I'd buy it as soon as it came back down. If it was $50 one day, $51 the next, and $52 the next day, then even if it dropped down to $51, I'd tell myself it wasn't as cheap as when I started, so I better keep waiting. Eventually a month would pass, and my calendar reminder would go off telling me it was time to invest again. But I hadn't invested for last month yet. So now I had 2 months saved up, which meant my decision on when to invest was even more important. My brain was feeling a tremendous amount of options around making these investment decisions, and I was just trying to buy one fund. I couldn't overcome this fear. Soon another month had piled up, then another. Anxiety set in about my failure to invest anything, and I called my friend Fred one night in a panic. Fred studied economics under John Nash at Princeton, worked in investment banking for years, and, more important, was someone I trusted enough to share my financial failures with. "I had the same problem," he said. "Then I made rules for myself. I have 3 rules. I wrote them down on a piece of paper, which I leave at my desk. I follow the 3 rules even if I don't want to. Rule number 1, if checking account is greater than $1,000, move all money over $1,000 into investing account. Rule number 2, if investing account is greater than $1,000, move all money over $1,000 into investments. Rule number 3, never break rule number 1 or rule number 2. Fred continued to say, "It works because I remove my brain from the equation. I don't have any choice, so I'm forced to be happy with how I've invested. If the fund went up in value, I tell myself I was smart for investing some earlier to capitalize on those gains. Like, if the market is at an all-time high and there has never been a worse time to buy, I tell myself, boy, I sure am smart only investing a little bit now and not my entire life savings. Alternatively, If the fund has gone down in value, I tell myself I was smart for saving money to benefit from lower prices today. It's a win-win. Now all my money is invested, I don't pay any advisor fees, and I don't spend any time thinking about it. Rules, limits, barriers. Creating mental brick walls to stop making decisions. Like the fish department with all the choices removed. Why can't we make rules for our own brain? Preserve our decision-making energy for decisions that matter. A guided workout at the gym, a preset breakfast shake. What happens when we give ourselves less choice? The unanticipated joy of being totally stuck. Daniel Gilbert, author of Stumbling on Happiness, wondered this too. He gave a TED talk about an experiment he ran on the Harvard campus. He said, "We created a photography course, a black and white photography course, and we allowed students to come in and learn how to use the darkroom. So we gave them cameras, they went around campus, they took 12 pictures of their favorite professors and the dorm room and their dog. They bring us the camera, we make up a contact sheet, they figure out which are the two best pictures, and we now spend 6 hours teaching them about darkrooms. And they blow two of them up, and they have two gorgeous 8x10 glossies of meaningful things to them. And we say, which one would you like to give up? They say, I have to give one up. And we say, oh yes, we need one as evidence of the class project, so you have to give me one. You have to make a choice. You get to keep one, and I get to keep one. Now there are two conditions in this experiment," he continues. "In one case, the students are told, but you know, if you want to change your mind, I'll always have the other photo here, and in the next 4 days, before I actually mail it to headquarters, I'll be glad to swap it out with you. Better yet, I'll check with you. You ever want to change your mind, it's totally returnable." The other half of the students are told the exact opposite. "Make your choice, and by the way, the mail is going out, gosh, in 2 minutes, to England. Your picture will be winging its way over the Atlantic. You will never see it again." Now, half of the students are asked to make predictions about how much they're going to come to like the picture they keep and the picture they leave behind. Other students are just sent back to their little dorm rooms, and they are measured on their liking and satisfaction with the picture. And look what we find. First of all, the students think they're going to maybe come to like the picture they chose a little more than the one they left behind, but these are not statistically significant differences. It's a very small increase, and it doesn't much matter whether they were in the reversible or the irreversible condition. Wrong-o! Bad simulators. Because here's what's really happening. Both right before the swap and 5 days later, people who are stuck with that picture, who have no choice, who can never change their mind, like it a lot. And people who are deliberating, should I return it? Have I gotten the right one? Maybe this isn't the good one. Maybe I left the good one. Have killed themselves. They don't like their picture, and in fact, even after the opportunity to swap has expired, they still don't like their picture. Why? Because the reversible condition is not conducive to the synthesis of happiness. Gilbert concludes, "So here's the final piece of this experiment. We bring in a whole new group of naive Harvard students and we say, you know, we're doing a photography course and we can do it one of two ways. We could do it so that when you take the two pictures, you'd have 4 days to change your mind. Or we're doing another course where you take the two pictures and you make up your mind right away and you can never change it. Which course would you like to be in?" Duh! 66% of the students, 2/3, prefer to be in the course where they have the opportunity to change their mind. Hello? 66% of the students choose to be in the course in which they will ultimately be deeply dissatisfied with the picture. No wonder we are exhausted from making decisions. Because we want to make those decisions. We want to go to the movie theater with the most movies playing. We like the restaurant with the long menu. We want the shoe store with the most shoes. But having more choice reduces our happiness. We get decision fatigue. What happens? We avoid the decision or we make a bad decision, and we always worry we made the wrong choice. This is why I always fail to invest any money. It's why, looking back at our wedding registry, Leslie and I wondered who picked some of the things on there. We had to go through it all again with fresh sponges. Barry Schwartz, author of The Paradox of Choice, says, "Freedom and autonomy are critical to our well-being, and choice is critical to our freedom and autonomy. Nonetheless," he continues, "though modern Americans have more choice than any group of people ever has before, and thus, presumably, more freedom and autonomy, we don't seem to be benefiting from it psychologically." Four simple words that will help you prioritize everything. You make fewer decisions. You do some 10 times faster, some 5 times faster, and some many times longer. But it all adds up to quicker decisions and focusing on what's important. You look at decisions you make on a daily basis and decide which ones to automate, regulate, effectuate, and debate. Ruby Watch Co. is one of the most popular restaurants in Toronto, ranked in the top 10 of thousands in the city, and run by celebrity chef Lynn Crawford. Before opening the restaurant, Lynn worked as executive chef at the Manhattan Four Seasons, starred in Restaurant Makeover, and wrote 2 best-selling cookbooks. Her restaurant operates like no other in the city. Reservations are taken at only 2 seating times, it's a flat $50 per person, and the 4-course fixed-price menu changes every day. What else is available besides the 4-course fixed-price menu? Nothing! There are no other choices. Nothing else to eat, no menus to choose from, no prices to think about, and everybody gets dessert. For the kitchen, there are only allergies to accommodate. Cooking is streamlined, dishes all the same size, waste is limited, and checks added quickly for faster turnaround. Everything arrives family style, in big dishes at the center of the table, and the dimly lit, chattery dining room is packed every night of the week. The Globe and Mail says, "It's nice for the chef who gets to be spontaneous. Also very nice for the chef to give up that whole challenge of offering different menu items, as the cost and stress of both stocking and cooking different foods is eliminated. It's so much easier." Lynn says, "The decision of what to choose at a restaurant can be overwhelming. I'm thrilled when someone says, 'Let me cook for you.' Delaying is gone, choosing nothing is gone, and businesses like Lynn's restaurant can benefit." Guess what Stanford researcher Sheena Iyengar reports Procter & Gamble found when they chopped the varieties of Head & Shoulders on the shelf from 26 to 15. When you remove half the number of bottles the customer sees, your sales must go down, right? Nope. They got a sales increase of 10%. When we are presented with too many decisions, we either 1. Do nothing. Our brains are exhausted, so we stop making decisions completely. We walk out in protest. This is what happens on forms where you need to pick one of 25 different investment funds for your pension, or 26 different varieties of shampoo. What do people do? Ignore them all. Go with the default. We are so tired by this point we quit completely. Or, 2, do poorly. Don't feel like quitting? Well, there is another option, making a decision that stinks. Being so exhausted you pick something, anything, just to get the decision-making done. Adding a $300 ice bucket to your wedding registry. Grabbing a king-size O. Henry at the end of your grocery shop. Easiest over best. Your brain is the world's most valuable piece of real estate. It produces world-changing ideas, creates beautiful art, and explores great mysteries of life. But trivial decisions and endless choices buzz in front of your brain all day. They're flashing lights, preventing you from pushing deeper. How can ding think about ping when all your ring endless decisions steal your deep thoughts? Tiny decisions squat on your primo lot rent-free. They don't pay. They don't apologize. They just steal your brain power. Sure, a lot of this comes from our increasingly connected world. Nicholas Carr, author of the New York Times bestseller The Shallows, says, "The net's interactivity gives us powerful new tools for finding information, expressing ourselves, and conversing with others. It also turns us into lab rats constantly pressing levers to get tiny pellets of social or intellectual nourishment. I made 285 decisions on an average day. My brain was contemplating, weighing, evaluating, and deciding every minute I was awake," But there is a secret to removing choice and making every decision at twice the speed. After studying personal leadership traits among successful Ivy League grads, Fortune 500 CEOs, and best-selling authors, I slowly discovered the most successful people use the same secret to rid their brains of all the extra weight of hundreds of decisions a day. It's simple. The just do it scribble. I'm now scribbling another box divided into four quadrants, with time on the vertical axis, ranging from low at the bottom to high at the top, and importance along the horizontal axis, with low on the left side and high on the right side. So time is on the vertical axis from low to high, and importance is on the horizontal axis from low to high. There it is. It's that simple. Every decision you make sits somewhere in this box. It takes a little time, or a lot. It's not very important, or it's a big deal. Here, let me fill it in for you. First, we write automate in the lower left corner. This is a decision that takes low time and is low importance. Buying toilet paper and detergent, paying the phone bill, deciding your route to work, picking your workout routine. If it's low in time and low in importance, your goal is to automate. Outsource your brain completely and don't think about it again. Set online refills to ship toilet paper and detergent monthly. Set up auto bill payments from your bank account. Download a traffic maps app and mindlessly follow the best route to work. And set a workout schedule and follow it. Free your brain. Just don't mistake these smaller decisions for the more important decisions in which they reside. Deciding to work out every day is important. Picking which dumbbell to lift next is not. To summarize, in the lower left quadrant, we've written the word automate, low in time and low in importance. What about the lower right-hand quadrant of the scribble? These are decisions that are low in time, but high in importance. Effectuate is the word we write in this lower right corner. Grabbing the kids from daycare, eating dinner with the family every night, saying hi to your team every morning. Effectuate is a big word with a simple meaning. Get her done. Nail it. Just do it. If it's low in time, but high in importance, your goal is to just do it. There is no decision to make. Simply effectuate. Right now, we have two words written in the scribble. We've written automate in the lower left-hand quadrant, and we've written effectuate in the lower right-hand quadrant. But what about that top left quadrant? What about the decisions that take a lot of time, but are not very important? Well, for those, we write down the word regulate in the upper left corner. Checking email, managing your calendar, doing chores. If it's high in time and low in importance, your goal is to regulate. Make rules and follow them. Set an email window, a single calendar review meeting, a chores blitz every Sunday morning instead of painfully doing one or two a day. And that leaves only the upper right-hand quadrant empty. The decisions that take a lot of time and are very important. The word we write in that quadrant is debate. Buying a house, picking a spouse, applying for a job, moving. High importance, high time decisions are the ones to spend the most time on. Debate in your head. Call trusted friends. List the pros and cons. Slow the decision down to molasses so you can engage in a proper debate. These are the ones that matter. Low time, low importance decisions get automated. Low time, high importance decisions get effectuated. Low importance, high time decisions get regulated. And this frees your brain to focus on the ones that matter. Automate, regulate, and effectuate all remove decisions from your head. What are you left with? Debate. Deep thinking, questioning, wondering, weighing big decisions that matter in order to avoid making bad ones. Every now and then, thinking about the decisions in your life and writing them down in this box will help sort out for yourself what matters and what doesn't. What can you automate so you never think about it again? What can you regulate so you do it in set times and windows? What can you effectuate as something you simply just do? And what can you debate? What big thoughts can you chew on to make sure you're doing the right thing? Over time, you will do this automatically, without thinking about it. You will have developed the muscle to automatically chunk out your decisions. Now, the secret isn't perfect. Sometimes small decisions will leak out and become big deals in your head, but that's okay. The goal is not to be perfect. The goal is just to be better than before. Automating, regulating, and effectuating free your mind and free your time. Your aching brain will thank you. Chapter 5. Removal number 2, the counterintuitive way to have more time. When I was 14 years old, I got my first job in a nepotism-riddled scandal. My cousin Anita let me work as a pharmacy technician in her tiny 600-square-foot pharmacy in small-town Ontario. It was the size of a large closet and located at the front door of a busy medical building with a walk-in clinic with lineups of coughing children streaming out the door all day. Even though it was tiny, the pharmacy filled hundreds of prescriptions a day in a non-stop, adrenaline-rushing, assembly line atmosphere. Prescriptions were dropped off, pills counted, and advice dispensed, sometimes in less than a minute. Screaming babies, snotty toddlers, and drugged-out moms were crammed together in a sardine tin of throat infections. I started in a white lab coat with a 3-hour Friday night shift. Backbreaking. Anita figured I couldn't do much damage on the slowest time of the week, so I was given a chance to perfect my pill counting with slightly shorter lines. Every Friday, I worked those 3 hours, got a ride in my dad's station wagon to Subway for a salami sub and white bread, then went home to watch Scully and Mulder do their thing on the X-Files. Now, when you have only 600 square feet of space, you only have 600 square feet of space. Elbows touched and hips bumped all day, and cold sandwiches were eaten on dirty footstools in the corner. Pill bottles were stashed above and below the counter, a tiny fridge and microwave wedged above the tiny sink, and you had to walk through the accountant's paperwork piles to get to the bathroom, which was stuffed with coats and boots. And try not to pee on the pyramids of ginger ale cases stacked on both sides of the toilet. The place did well, so my cousin teamed up with my dad to open a second location 20 minutes away. This time, they said, we'll actually have room to move. So they built the second store 3 times the size of the first. There was enough shelf space to actually have greeting cards, and sunblock, and bandages, and the staff could move freely, like ballet dancers at the Met. Lots of air, shelves everywhere. I turned 16 and started working at the second store as my summer job. I had perfected counting pills now, and had worked up the courage to actually talk to customers. I had also grown a wispy mustache, so I no longer looked like an 11-year-old in Coke bottle glasses behind the counter. Now I looked 13. I noticed immediately that the second store was worse than the first in almost every way. First off, there was no extra storage space. Where was the extra storage space? Every shelf was full and boxes were stuffed above and below the counter. Because there were more items on the shelves, there was more overstock of more items, so now you had to watch so you didn't pee onto canes or greeting cards beside the toilet. Communication was more difficult too. Messages were passed on paper and notebooks instead of the tiny staff just talking amongst themselves. There was room for 2 computers now, which led to nice-looking drop-off and pickup stations instead of just one spot. But that meant customer confusion and time lost moving everything between 2 spots. The extra distance also meant customers sometimes felt nobody was around when they wanted to drop off a prescription. And when their pills were ready, you now had to call them or find them down an aisle. So the pharmacist took more time giving out prescriptions. Prescriptions took longer to fill. Everybody was working as fast as they could, but it felt slow to customers. What happened? Work expands to fill the space available, and the result is lower quality. Although this story seems like it's about having more space, it's actually about having more time. With longer counters, twice the drop-offs, and more room for customers to walk around, the new store offered more time to fill prescriptions, so it took more time. Have you ever got a prescription filled in the middle of a gigantic warehouse store? Takes a while, doesn't it? The single law that determines how long anything takes to do. In November 1955, a strange article appeared in The Economist by an unknown writer named C. Northcote Parkinson. Readers who started skimming the article, titled Parkinson's Law, were met with sarcastic, biting paragraphs, poking sharp holes in government bureaucracy, and mocking ever-expanding corporate structures. It was searing criticism, masked as an information piece. It began innocently enough with the following paragraph. It is a commonplace observation that work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. Thus, an elderly lady of leisure can spend the entire day in writing and dispatching a postcard to her niece at Bognor Regis. An hour will be spent in finding the postcard, another in hunting for spectacles, half an hour in search for the address, an hour and a quarter in composition, and 20 minutes in deciding whether or not to take an umbrella when going to the pillar box in the next street. The total effort which would occupy a busy man for 3 minutes all told may in this fashion leave another person prostrate after a day of doubt, anxiety, and toil. The thesis of the piece was in the first sentence. It is a commonplace observation that work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. Haven't we heard advice like this before? The ultimate inspiration is the deadline, for instance. If you leave it till the last minute, it only takes a minute to do. Or how about, the contents of your purse will expand to fill all available space? In the second pharmacy that my cousin opened, there was more time available. Customers weren't staring at you. There was no walk-in clinic next door outputting prescription after prescription, so there was time to look up research and answer questions about cough syrup. It was a calm environment as opposed to a hectic environment, and work expanded to fill this time. Think back to bringing homework home from school on the weekends. There was nothing better than a weekend, but the dull pain of having to do a page of math problems and write a book summary loomed like a faint black cloud over Friday night, all day Saturday, and Sunday morning. I remember I would always work on my homework Sunday night. But once in a while, if we were going away for the weekend, if I had busy plans on both days, I would actually get my homework done on Friday night. The deadline had artificially become sooner in my mind. And what happened? It felt great. It felt like I had more time all weekend. A fake early deadline created more space. How do you cut all meeting time in half? As part of a job I had a few years ago, I suddenly took ownership over the company's weekly meeting for all employees. It was a rambly Friday morning affair without a clear agenda, presentation guidelines, or timelines, all in front of 1,000 people. The CEO would speak for as long as he wanted about whatever he wanted and then pass the mic to the next executive sitting at a table, who would speak as long as he wanted about whatever he wanted before passing the mic to the next person. It was unpredictable. And starting at 9 a.m. and rolled into 10 a.m., sometimes 10:30 a.m., and occasionally 11 a.m., people would go on tangents. Nobody was concise. And everyone would leave 2 hours later in a daze, trying to remember all the mixed priorities they heard at the beginning of the meeting. So I worked with the CEO to redesign the meeting. We created 5 segments of 5 minutes each and set up an agenda and schedule of presenters in advance. The segments were called The Numbers, Outside Our Walls, The Basics 101, Sell, 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 and Mailbag, where the CEO actually opened letters and answered questions from the audience on stage. The new meeting was 25 minutes long, and it never went over time once. How come? Because I downloaded a dong sound effect that we played over the speakers with 1 minute left, a ticking clock sound effect that played with 15 seconds left, and then the AV guys actually cut off a person's microphone when the time hit zero. If you hit zero, you would be talking on stage but nobody could hear you. You just had to stop. What happened? Well, at first everybody complained. I need 7 minutes to present, they'd say. I need 10 minutes. I need much, much longer because I have something very, very important to say. We said no, and we shared this quote from a Harvard Business Review interview with former GE CEO Jack Welch. Jack says, "For a large organization to be effective, it must be simple. For a large organization to be simple, its people must have self-confidence and intellectual self-assurance. Insecure managers create complexity. Frightened, nervous managers use thick, convoluted planning books and busy slides filled with everything they've known since childhood. Real leaders don't need clutter. People must have the self-confidence to be clear, precise, to be sure that every person in their organization, highest to lowest, understands what the business is trying to achieve. But it's not easy. You can't believe how hard it is for people to be simple, he continued, how much they fear being simple. They worry that if they're simple, people will think they're simple-minded. In reality, of course, it's just the reverse. Clear, tough-minded people are the most simple. So then what happened at my company? Well, with a clear time limit, presenters practiced. They timed themselves. They prioritized their most important messages and scrapped everything else. They used bullet points and summary slides. We introduced the concept by saying, if you can't say it concisely in 5 minutes, you can't say it. By then, people doze off or start checking their email. Have you ever tried listening to someone talk for 20 straight minutes? Unless they are extremely clear, concise, and captivating, or reading the happiness equation to you, it's a nightmare. Everybody got a bit scared of their mic cutting off, so the meetings were always 25 minutes. What happened to productivity? Well, 1,000 people saved an hour every week. That's 2.5% of total company time saved with just one small change. How do you complete a 3-month project in 1 day? Sam Reyna is a leader in the technology industry. He oversees the design and development of a large website with millions of hits a day. He has more than 60 people working for him. It's a big team. There are many moving parts, from designers to coders to copy editors. How does he motivate his team to design and launch entirely new pages for the website from scratch? He follows Parkinson's law and cuts down time. He books his entire team for secret one-day meetings and then issues them a challenge in the morning that he says they're going to get done by the end of the day. There is only 1 day to make an entire website, from designing to layout to testing, everything. Everyone freaks out about the deadline, and then everyone starts working together. What does Sam say about it? The less time we have to do it, the more focused and organized we are. We all work together. We have to. There is no way we'd hit the deadline otherwise, and we always manage to pull it off. By spending a day on a project that would otherwise take months, he frees up everyone's thinking time, transactional time, and work time. Nobody will be thinking about the website in the bed, bath, or bus again. They can think about other things. There will be no emails about the website, no out-of-office messages, no meetings set up to discuss it, no confusion about who said what. Everyone talks in person at the same time until it's done. So what's the counterintuitive secret to having more time? Chop the amount of time you have to do it. The less time available, the more effort you put in. There is no choice. The deadline is right here. Think of how focused you are in an exam. 2 hours to do it? You do it in 2 hours. That deadline creates an urgency that allows the mind to prioritize and focus. The more time available, the less effort we put in overall. A little thought today, start the project tomorrow, revisit it next week. We procrastinate. Why? Because we're allowed to. There is no penalty. Nothing kills productivity faster than a late deadline. What does C. Northcote Parkinson say about waiting to get it done? Delay is the deadliest form of denial, he says. Have you ever finished a project on time, and then the teacher announces to the class that the deadline has been extended? What a bummer. Now, even though you finished at the original deadline, you get the pain and torture of mentally revisiting your project over and over again until you hand it in. Could it be better? How can I improve it? Remember, work expands to fill the time available for its completion. At my cousin's second pharmacy, in the original 1,000-person company meeting, in a normal website development cycle, what invisible liability do you find? Time. Too much of it. And work expanding to fill it as a result. So, what's the solution? Create last-minute panic. Move deadlines up, revise them for yourself, and remember you are creating space after the project has been delivered. Remember, a late deadline is painful. Nothing gets done. Do only nerds do their homework on Friday night? Maybe, but they're the ones with the whole weekend to party. Chapter 6. Removal number 3. How to add an hour to a day with only one small change. I got my first office job in my early 20s. For 4 months between school years and college, I held the sexy job title of summer intern at a big consulting company in a downtown high-rise. Casey was my boss and the head of the project I was assigned to for the summer, which was for one of the world's largest oil and gas companies. One Monday morning, I was sitting in his glass-windowed corner office with the rising sun beaming onto the desk between us. More than 3 months of late-night stress and working on weekends had finally rolled up to right now. We were minutes away from our big presentation. Casey's sense of humor had carried me through all the challenges and Chinese takeout boxes leading up to today, but he had just asked me a last-minute question that made me snap. My nerves were frayed. I had no energy left. "Why do we have an assumption in here instead of an actual figure?" Casey asked me. "Because Roger didn't write back to my 3 emails asking him for the right number, and he never gave us a phone number where we could call him. I tried his assistant twice and never heard back either. It's like he forgot we existed. You know that." Roger was the highly touted CEO of the oil and gas company who everybody looked up to. He was highlighted in flashy magazine articles and known as a people leader who espoused work-life balance while nonchalantly beating his numbers every year. Meanwhile, employees at the company told us he ate lunch in the company cafeteria, drove a beat-up truck to work, and had dinner with his kids every night. The man was a legend. After our introductory meeting 3 months back, I wrote Roger an email summarizing our meeting and next steps. He didn't write back. I then took my laptop home every night in case Roger emailed with an urgent question or request. I checked email every half an hour, just in case the CEO of the company ever emailed late at night asking for a project update the next morning. Just so if he ever needed something, anything, I'd be there. But there was nothing. In 3 months of working for him, he didn't write me a single email. He didn't write Casey any emails either. We dropped a few questions along the way, but never heard back. And I had just told Casey my messages to his assistant weren't returned either. Now suddenly it was time for our big presentation, and Casey was questioning why I didn't have certain numbers. I steadied my nerves as we stepped into the boardroom where Roger was sitting and chatting with our company president. He smiled and got up to shake our hands and thank us for the work we'd done. "I'm so excited," he said with a big grin. "I can't tell you guys how much I appreciate how hard you've been working. You guys are geniuses. I'm going to learn so much from this chat." The anger I felt about his unresponsiveness suddenly melted. I felt like $1 million. We jumped into the presentation and had a great discussion. It was casual, engaging, and open. He loved it, and I couldn't believe how relaxed everything felt. He was talking to us like old friends. After the meeting was done, there was so much trust between us. So as we were packing up, I thought about it for a split second and decided to ask him one last question. I couldn't help myself. "Roger, thanks so much for today," I said. "We had trouble running some numbers by you in advance, and I know we didn't hear from you on the additional questions we had. So, just for my own learning, can I ask why you don't write or respond to emails? How do you do that?" His eyes opened a bit and he seemed surprised by the question, but he wasn't fazed. "Neil," he said, "there's a problem with email. After you send one, the responsibility of it goes away from you and becomes the responsibility of the other person. It's a hot potato. An email is work given to you by somebody else." I nodded, thinking about all the emails I got from Casey and my coworkers. "I do read emails," he continued, "but the ones looking for something are always much less urgent than they seem. When I don't respond, one of two things happens. Either one, the person figures it out on their own. Or two, they email me again because it really was important." "Sure," he continued, "I send 1 or 2 emails a day, but they usually say, 'Give me a call,' or 'Let's chat about this,' unless they're from my wife. I answer all of those. I was very confused. How was the CEO of a multi-billion dollar company with thousands of employees not emailing? He paused to look at me and sensed I didn't get it, so he continued. You know what, Neil? Since I don't write many emails, I don't receive many either. I probably only get 5 or 10 emails a day. 5 emails a day? Here I was, working at a consulting company writing emails morning, noon, and night. It was the same for everyone. My inbox has 700 emails, my coworkers would say and sigh. I did emails all Sunday afternoon, they'd say. There was no way around it. After all, our bosses sent urgent emails at 7 a.m. Saturday, late Sunday afternoon, or 11 p.m. on Friday night. I knew this was common in my company and others. McKinsey had even reported that office workers spend on average 28% of their time answering email, almost a third. And Baden, one of the world's largest email management services, says the average person gets 147 emails a day. We were all attached to our cell phones and computers, firing emails around, working hard to get everything done. It was part of the job, and we all wanted to do a good job. Suddenly, it started to click why Roger was known to have lunch in the cafeteria with employees every day and drive home for dinner with his family every night. He didn't respond to hot potatoes. He didn't write back to emails and create email chains. I looked up at Roger again, and he continued. Most of the time, Neil, he said, people really do figure it out on their own. They realize they know the answer. They keep on moving. They develop confidence for next time. They become better themselves. Your assumptions in the slides today weren't perfect, but they worked perfectly well, and you learned by doing them. Don't get me wrong. I sometimes walk over to chat with a person or pick up the phone. But if I wrote back to an email, I'd be sending a hot potato, and nobody wants to be asked by the CEO to do something, never mind on an evening or weekend. Why? Because people would drop everything to reply, and they would expect me to reply to that. Basically, if I sent an email, it would never end. So I end it. How to protect your most valuable asset. You have only one brain, and it focuses on only one thing at a time. Your brain is the most incredible and complex object in the universe. We have never seen anything like it. We barely understand it. We use it, but we don't know how we use it. When we kick, we pull our leg back and swing it forward. When we think, we just think. As Cliff once said on Cheers, interesting little article here. It says the average human being only uses 17% of his brain. Boy, you realize what that means? We don't use a full, 64%. Your brain is capable of infinite possibilities, producing great works of art, building businesses, raising children. Brains made the Starry Night and the Great Wall of China, the Beatles and the Bible. Brains made planes, trains, and automobiles. Brains make your life what it is and die when you do. The good news is, for no money down, no annual fees, and no monthly interest, you get one free copy of the universe's most complex and powerful object. It's yours for life. The only bad news is there is no warranty, it requires daily recharging, and even the longest-lasting models in the world last only 40,000 days. The average model lasts only 25,000 days. You break it, it's broken. Seat belts, bike helmets, and exercise are mandatory. For power, your brain recharges with 6 to 8 hours of sleep a day and as much healthy food as possible. That's a lot of gas. It takes the equivalent of more than 16 apples a day just to power your brain. But remember, the world's most powerful supercomputer has been compacted into a 3-pound pile of flesh in your skull, so no wonder it needs so much energy. Yes, nearly a full third of all the food you eat goes straight to powering your brain. Roger was the smartest guy at the company, no doubt about it. In the years since, he's gone up and up and up, all while eating lunch in the cafeteria every day and dinner with his family every night. I had worked with Roger only 3 months when I learned how to add an hour to the day with only one small change. How? Block access. Protect your brain. Guard it. Remove all entry points to your brain except a single one you can control. In addition to Roger's approach to email, I learned later that he didn't have a desk phone, personal email address, or any social media accounts. Fuel your brain and let it run wild by removing access points. Close the doors and lock the windows, but answer the bell. What's the bell? It's your number one top priority. What was Roger's bell? Emails from the chairman of the board and his family. Not voicemail, not text messages, not anything else. Have you ever shopped in a small town convenience store where they have a little bell on the front counter? They are busy stocking shelves. They are busy unpacking boxes. They are busy placing orders. But when you ring that bell, they are right there, right away. That's what it means to close the doors and lock the windows, but answer the bell. Let your brain produce great work. Savor space and power your biggest ideas, most passionate efforts, and greatest accomplishments. The greatest misconception you share with every other employee. Multitasking. Doing two or more things at once. How often do you hear people use that word? What does it mean? And where did it even come from? We have to go all the way back to a paper written by IBM in 1965 to find the origin of the word multitasking. How is it defined? The paper says, the ability of a microprocessor to apparently process several tasks simultaneously. Yes, that is the actual meaning, right from the paper. Want to hear it again? This time let me emphasize one word. The ability of a microprocessor to apparently process several tasks simultaneously. Apparently? Apparently? What do they mean by apparently? You mean even computers don't actually process several tasks at the same time? Well, no, they don't. Another quote, another emphasis from me. Computer multitasking in single-core microprocessors actually involves time-sharing the processor. Only one task can actually be active at a time, but tasks are rotated through many times a second. Time sharing. We've heard of time sharing, like splitting a lake house with five other couples throughout the year. Everyone has the illusion of owning a lake house, but really, you're all just going at different times. And this is for single-core microprocessors, those with one brain. You know who else has one brain? You and me. We can make a dual-core computer, but we haven't developed a dual-brain baby yet. That kid will actually be able to multitask. Now, I know what you might be thinking. Just because a computer doesn't actually do more than one task at once, who says you can't? After all, haven't you ever brushed your teeth while taking off your socks, texted while driving, or answered emails on a conference call? No. You haven't actually done any of those things. You have dangerously taken tiny breaks from driving to text, and you have taken tiny breaks from texting to drive, thankfully. But you've also taken tiny breaks from brushing your teeth to remove your socks. You have taken tiny breaks from removing your socks to brush your teeth. Together, you may have accomplished all of it, but you have created only the illusion of multitasking. As my friend Mike once told me, screwing up two things at the same time isn't multitasking. Let's look at one final quote about multitasking in a computer's brain. This one comes from a white paper written by the company National Instruments. It says, in the case of a computer with a single CPU core, only one task runs at any point in time, meaning that the CPU is actively executing instructions for that task. Multitasking solves the problem by scheduling which task may run at any given time and when another waiting task gets a turn. This act of reassigning a CPU from one task to another one is called a context switch. When context switches occur frequently enough, the illusion of parallelism is achieved. Yes, when context switches occur frequently enough, the illusion of parallelism is achieved. The single greatest misconception of every employee is that they can multitask, that their brains can do two things at once. But they can't. This is the illusion of parallelism. When jumping between many things is perfectly scheduled, everyone will think you're actually doing two things at the same time. But you're not. You're simply scheduling them in. Have you ever seen anybody checking emails while pressing mute on a conference call? They aren't listening to the call. But they said hello at the beginning and will context switch if anybody says their name. Like, Linda, what do you think of the proposal? Suddenly, Linda stops emailing and gives her 2 cents. The illusion of parallelism is achieved. Do you remember when doctors were the only ones with pagers? Sometimes they were on call and they carried their pagers around. Sometimes they weren't on call and there was no way to reach them. If there was